For WTOP News, this is the Book Report. War has been a fact of life for this relatively young century, starting with the 9/11 attacks and continuing through conflicts involving Afghanistan, Syria, Sudan, and now Israel and Hamas, each of these creating a gravitational pull on the U.S. and the danger of a wider regional conflict. Facing this upheaval, the question is, what can we learn from the last 22 years? What can we learn about the people involved in these conflicts, often only described with good guy versus bad guy narratives? What the Taliban Told Me by Ian Fritz, just out from Simon & Schuster, is a memoir that details his experiences listening to and translating hundreds of hours of Taliban radio communications over two tours as an airborne cryptologic linguist in Afghanistan, and what he learned from listening to these private, unguarded conversations between men identified as our sworn enemies. I sat down to talk to Ian Fritz on the eve of the book's release.
So as concisely as possible, really, what is the book about? What is the story that you're telling here?
The book is about my time training and becoming and working as an airborne cryptologic linguist on board Air Force Special Operations aircraft in Afghanistan. I spent a combined 6 months in Afghanistan with multiple hundreds of hours on board aircraft. So there's a lot of details in there, but for the most part, it's about the work I did listening to the Taliban in Afghanistan in 2011.
Now we're leaning into another Middle Eastern crisis right now. So this may sound to some people, you know, like a war from the past since we're not there anymore. So my question, why write this book? Why this book? Why now?
The honest to whatever deity you believe in answer is that someone asked me to.
I mean, it's a good answer. I like honest.
The slightly more nuanced answer to that is that I did write an essay that was in the Atlantic around the time of the so-called fall, right? Around the time that an awful lot of people were dying in an awful lot of terrible ways because we were leaving Afghanistan 10 years later than we should have. I wrote that because, and I think this is true for very, very, very many people who were in Afghanistan or in Iraq, I had a lot of feelings about the withdrawal, and I had a lot of feelings about my feelings about the withdrawal, and I had no idea how to deal with those feelings and those feelings about feelings and the metacognition. And the only way for me to figure it out was to write it all down. So it was the only way I could get the thoughts out of my head. And I did that, and I did write an essay, and I think this extends to the book that essay was important.
So the actual job of an airborne cryptologic linguist is you're on an airship, you're on a low-flying airship, a gunship, and you're listening to communications on the ground so that you can determine in real time which Afghans are Taliban and which are innocent civilians. Can you talk a little bit about how that works in real time?
So what my job looked like is me with big headphones on, listening to something on the ground, typing on a laptop because I'm transcribing what I'm hearing so that I don't have to just keep it memorized. And I'm listening to that in Pashto or in Dari, but usually in Pashto. And in near real time, I'm translating that to English. And once something is useful or important, I have to then tell that to the crew on the plane. So I would tell that to the navigator, because the navigator, despite their name, is also responsible for talking to people on the ground. So the guys, the soldiers, men and women that are actually fighting on the ground, they need to know what I'm hearing, right? Because maybe I'm hearing the Taliban say, hey, we put an IED at that spot in the road and, you know, we're waiting for the Americans to show up. Or, hey, we're bringing the big gun so that we can do this ambush or something like that. I have to be able to relay that information to the navigator on the plane so that the navigator could then tell the people on the ground, like, hey, you know, you might get ambushed right now, or hey, there's an IED in the road. Those are sort of... Those allow for time, I guess, right? If I know that there's an ID in the road, I can say, well, hey, it's up there, it's over there, like people have time. In real time, you know, I was over at battles that people were actively shooting at one another, right? So Taliban are shooting Americans are shooting back, and somewhere in all of that noise, I hear the Taliban say, hey, we're bringing, you know, another gun over to location X within the village that we're fighting in, and I have to be able to very, very quickly provide that information.
Right. So essentially, we're talking about a role that's part reconnaissance and part sort of battlefield translator. And in order to do that job, you had to learn two different languages that are native to Afghanistan, Pashto and Dari. So can you just talk a little bit about those two different languages, and what the differences are between the two?
Sure. So Dari is sort of the name that Westerners gave to the Afghan dialect of Farsi. Farsi is, more people know of that language. It's spoken in Iran. It's also spoken in Afghanistan. Dari sort of just has an accent. That's really the only functional difference between it and Farsi. Dari is sort of it's the governmental language, right? It's what you would, if you would listen back in the day to the president, Hamid Karzai, speaking on, you know, the news or radio, he would have spoken Dari. Most like government paperwork is in Dari. The Afghan National Army traditionally speaks Dari. So that is a useful language for the military to have, linguists who speak a language. But because I was assigned to special operations, as I said before, the Taliban doesn't tend to speak Dari. The Taliban tends to speak Pashto. And so I had to, in order to be useful for special operations, the Air Force decided, well, you should probably speak Pashto. So they sent me and my best friend back to language school to learn Pashto so that we could, you know, actually perform our job in Afghanistan on board special operations aircraft.
You actually had a predisposition, really, as a young person to be able to absorb and learn languages. And I think, what do you attribute that to?
I specifically maybe had a leg up because my mother was raised speaking three languages. So she grew up, English was not her first language. French and Bambara, which is a language spoken in Mali, were her first languages, and then English. And so I don't speak French, I don't speak Bambara, but I heard languages a lot from the time I was, you know, a baby. And I think that probably had something to do with it. You know, people who grew up bilingual tend to have an easier time learning other languages. And so perhaps even just hearing them, you know, helped me a little bit.
So you graduated from high school, and what made you decide to enlist in the military? As you tell the story in the book, the jacket describes it as a decision of necessity. What made you decide to enlist?
Yeah. The biggest thing was that I didn't get into college graduating out of high school, and I grew up pretty poor and didn't really have anything else going on. I had a stable job and I could, you know, afford to live that job as a waiter. But there wasn't going to be anything bigger than that in my life. I grew up in a town of like 10,000 people in North Florida. There's not really anything there. A recruiter had come to my high school when I was in 10th grade, and he had talked about this job of an airborne cryptologic linguist. And I had this vague idea that I wanted to learn languages or something or other. And because I didn't get into college, I remembered, well, there's a thing where someone will pay you to do this instead of, you know, you paying when you go to college.
Did you have an ideology of any kind with regard to the U.S.'s activity in the Middle East when you signed up? Were you just sort of an open book, you know, sorry, blank canvas going in?
I would not say now that I have very strong ideologies, I don't think I had one then. I was very under, if not ill-informed about world events, that's for sure. I was in seventh grade when 9/11 happened. And it was a big deal, but I was however many miles away Lake City, Florida is from New York. I'd never heard of the World Trade Center or the Twin Towers or, you know, any of that before 9/11. By the time I joined, I maybe knew a little bit more. I think, you know, Iraq was more prevalent in the minds of people my age, like in high school. Afghanistan maybe hadn't become quite as big a thing. I for sure felt that the U.S. was good, you know, that if we were doing things, we were doing them right, because that's what I'd been told my whole life, right, in school and history classes and everything. But I didn't have any real opinion on, like, policy or, like, the ins and outs of why we were doing what we were doing.
When you were listening to their conversations, I think what set you apart from the rest of your crew members was the quasi-intimacy of being able to listen to the communications between them. So what did listening to that tell you?
Yeah, so spending hundreds of hours listening to the Taliban talk told me where their humanity resided, both within them and between them. And it told me perhaps even more about where my humanity resided, both in me and between me and them, and between me and the men and women I worked with.
Let's talk about your humanity. You were able to find, I don't know, would I call it a sympathy? Would I call it an understanding of them? What would you call it?
I think both of those are pretty good words for it. I think at the time, understanding would have been a better word because it was That's a more detached word, I think, than sympathy. Understanding why they were fighting, because earlier I didn't have an ideology going in, but we were all told why the Taliban was fighting us, right? It was because they were enemies of democracy, or they were enemies of Christianity, or they wanted to conduct jihad, or all these sorts of things. And that's certainly true for many, many members of the Taliban, and probably truer for the actual monolithic entity that is now the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, that Taliban. But the individual dudes are just like individual dudes, right? And they're doing bad things, absolutely. That doesn't necessarily remove them from the level of humanity, or at least many of the people I was listening to, it didn't necessarily remove them from the level of humanity. Some of them, for sure, but not all of them.
When I read the part about your discussion with Ed, about your reaction to the killing of Osama bin Laden, it was interesting because it was the first time I had ever read that perspective. You were in the storage container, right, that you were staying in, and you found out on the internet several hours later. I actually remember it very vividly because I was in Pittsburgh. I was in a hotel, and Obama came on television, and then everybody started. I could literally hear people cheering in the streets. Talk a little bit about how the experience of actually listening to the Taliban's interpersonal communications contribute to that reaction, or was that just you?
Part of it was probably just me. But I do pretty firmly believe that listening to those interactions was a major part of it. I mean, you used a word earlier that I do think is true and is accurate, of enlightening, but the corollary or the counterpart to enlightening is darkening. And, I do think it's ultimately a good thing for me and for many people, but the darkening that the Taliban brought me, right, was that, yeah, anybody celebrating, people celebrating the streets of Pittsburgh that we killed a guy, like, why? And what is that giving you? What is that giving the earth? Like, what is that giving other people, right? The Osama bin Laden being dead, that's probably, that is a net positive, for sure. Like, him being dead and Al-Qaeda being weakened is a net positive. But that is not the same thing as saying celebrating someone getting shot in the face.
I know that you addressed it somewhat in one of the very final chapters, if not the very last chapter. You were privy to information or privy to communications between human beings that civilians, Americans, or most of the readers of your book have not been privy to. And what would you say to anyone who would criticize this book as perhaps humanizing or sympathizing, I guess, with a regime or a group of people who are responsible for a lot of not cool things? How would you respond to that criticism?
So if someone were to make that argument, it would be a valid, I think, initial reaction. I make it pretty clear in the book, I think, that I don't sympathize with the regime, right? Like, absolutely not. The repression of ethnic minorities, the repression of religion, the repression of women, the repression of young girls, like, none of that I sympathize with. What I do sympathize with is individual people who were invaded by another country for the fourth time in 50 years and saw many of their friends and family killed seemingly indiscriminately. Like, and I think that if anyone can't sympathize with that, can't sympathize with someone watching their neighbor get killed by a bomb fall out of the sky when that neighbor never did anything wrong, regardless of the other context of that, regardless of like why anybody's in Afghanistan or what the Taliban stands for, I don't know what to say to you, because those are still people that aren't always awful all the time. And really, I'm sympathizing more with so many people who suffered despite not really playing any part in like the Taliban writ large, right? This, the actual regime, these guys, they're just like pawns on the ground.
Why do you think it's important for people to read and understand your experience as you've written in this book?
I think it's important because we are always going to have, if whatever we call it, conflict, battles, outright wars, right? As you mentioned, what's happening now, these things aren't going away anytime soon. Humanity hasn't figured out how to not fight yet. And I think a major portion of that, of a major reason for why we haven't figured out how to not fight, is that we're sort of incapable of listening to one another. And yeah, so the military spent a few $100,000 teaching me how to listen in another language, to actually listen to the guys fighting. Fine. Not everyone has to do that, right? You can listen to the stories of those people who fought. Like, there are books of poetry about the Taliban, right? Or, you know, I had this experience and I'm fortunate enough that someone asked me to write about it. I can talk about it somewhat intelligently. Seeing that, other people being able to see that, maybe one day would hopefully prevent wars from being as bad as they are. Like, I'm not naive enough to say that we're not going to have war anymore because of anything I do or anything anybody does. But we could maybe not have these cries for bloodlust, these cries for massive wars.
Great stuff. I really, really appreciate you and your publisher taking the time to get with us today on the WTOP Book Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you all for listening. This is the Book Report for WTOP News and WTOP.com. I'm Tariq King.